Brigadier Calvert, Royal Six.
And as I was saying, there was no jungle in China except on the borders of Indochina and in the island of Hainan. Now I'll get on to the members of this mission, because they're an interesting lot. First of all, I'll mention two distinguished officers who came from Abyssinia. They were Lieutenant Colonel Count Bentinck, B-E-N-T-I-N-C-K. He comes from that family of diplomats which whose names rear up throughout our last 300 years of dealings with Europe. He and the other one is Brocklehurst, who is a baronet, B-R-O-C-K-L-E-H-U-R-S-T, a very well-travelled man who had been to most countries in the world. They had been, and plus a Lieutenant Colonel Musgrave, who was a territorial gunner, who was a lesser man altogether. These three had been in charge of missions in Abyssinia. They had penetrated the borders of Abyssinia from Kenya and from Aden. They were supporting various rasses, that's like earls, in Abyssinia, and some of these rasses were opposed to the King Emperor Haile Selassie. Now, when Wingate was told to go and invade Abyssinia from the Sudan, he was given very definite instructions by Wavell that he should take the Emperor Haile Selassie with him and put him on the throne. You'll understand that communications from inside a guerrilla area and outside are fairly remote, and it's the original instructions which stick in your memory. Wingate's operations are pretty well known, but I should remind people that he had carried out, apart from a number of victories and achievements, he had carried out the extraordinary operation where he, by subterfuge and by the courage of his men and detachments, and especially a very fine lot of officers, had caused 14,000 Italians and their colonial troops to surrender to about 500 of his own men. It was one of the greatest victories of all time, but it was hushed up because by the people who didn't want to make Wingate a hero. Then I think at this time General Cunningham was commander-in-chief in Abyssinia, and Wavell had unfortunately left. Cunningham sent a signal to Wingate that he did not want Wingate to enter Addis Ababa with Haile Selassie. But Wingate felt that he must carry out his role, and he marched into Addis Ababa, and I have some slides of it, in which he and the King Emperor of Abyssinia rode in on horses, rather like Jesus Christ riding into Jerusalem. They were hailed as liberators, of course, and Haile Selassie was put on the throne, and Wingate was his advisor. This didn't suit Cunningham and his own advisors. How it got on with the Foreign Office, I don't know. But I understand that there was opposition to a black emperor, I think I've mentioned this, by people in Kenya, and especially by the South Africans. Haile Selassie, amongst other things, objected to the British support of some of these RASs, I think one was Rastafari, who were his rivals and his enemies. Fighting was still going on in Abyssinia at this time. And so he saw Cunningham and had no got no satisfaction. So he spoke to Wingate again, and Wingate said, as a King Emperor, I should send a signal to our King Emperor, George VI, on a King Emperor to King Emperor basis, and putting in your complaint. And I can get that message transmitted. Haile Selassie did this, and King George VI naturally sent it to Churchill, who gave everybody considered a rocket and said these other missions must be removed from Abyssinia straight away because our policy is to put Haile Selassie back on his throne, this is the first bit of area we've conquered, and this will make other people realize what our war aims are. Naturally, Cunningham was incensed about this, and Wingate was ordered back to return to Cairo, and he had been given a bar to his DSO for his operations, but otherwise he was rather an outcast in Cairo. He was suffering from a lot of tropical diseases, and he was in depressive mood. It was then that he attempted suicide to cut his throat. He was a bit of a manic depressive, like so many of our great heroes, like Nelson and Pitt and others. I have this on the advice of Dr. Sargent, who is a psychiatric advisor to St. Thomas's Hospital.
Did he treat Wingate?
No, but no, those are my own comments. But it was... I'd like to digress a bit further here because it fits in. Only 2 or 3 years ago, in 1984, I was sent some papers from a doctor whom I knew, who had had a lot to do with intelligence and so on, and he said this might interest you. And it was the obituary of a famous doctor by another famous doctor, and it was appearing in the British Medical Journal. In this obituary, the author mentions the fact that they were both together in Cairo when they heard that a famous general had committed suicide. As they went in to see him, an Irish doctor said, "Look at his blood count." They examined it and found it was General Wingate, or Major Wingate as he then was, and they looked at his blood count and found he was suffering from cerebral malaria. Now, as he said in his obituary, this can all be looked up in the British Medical Journal files, it is well known, of course, that one of the aspects of cerebral malaria is that the patient is liable to thoughts of suicide. He gets so depressed. We watched Wingate's recovery, and he showed no signs whatever of mental disturbance. And so this can be written off his medical history. Then there was a letter to this senior officer who'd written the obituary from the British Medical Council accusing him of publicizing medical secrets, and that he must appear before them to answer to these charges. I had this here, so I got in touch with General Wingate's, one of General Wingate's brothers, who is a judge, Judge Granville Wingate, who was in the Sussex Circuit. And he got on to some senior judges, and they confronted the British Medical Council with this and said, "It's utterly disgraceful that you should try and interfere, because, as I saw it, as I had also seen it, the effect on his son and on their families. Surely his son should know that there was no madness in the family or in his father. This was a very important thing that he should know, and it was not of any wartime secrecy which should take precedent over that." And so the whole case was dropped. But I mention it to show how some people, even 40 years after Wingate's death, and on occasion of this, still pursued this bitterness. Because this goes on to go back to Burma. We had Bentinck and Brocklehurst and Musgrave, and they arrived in Burma, naturally very browned off with Wingate, and for them being dismissed. They were excellent officers, and Wingate always said he had no question of their bravery at all. All it was their role. However, they were very bitter.
What other things did they say about Wingate?
Oh, they said he was mad, that he was a dangerous officer to put in charge, that he was, they accused him almost of everything, from being a traitor. I've seen that in a book on Auchinleck, accusing Wingate of being a traitor because he was supporting the Jews against the Arabs. And they were influential people, these. And later, I'll carry on with this, I think it's the right way to do it. When General Alexander was brought in to supersede, I'm forgetting his name now, General the GOC&C in Burma, they went up to General Alexander and said that, I ought to say this, now I better say I better We'll go further back. I better shall talk about the arrival of Wingate. I had been, this is quite later on, I had, it was after Pearl Harbor, the Japanese had attacked Burma, Rangoon had fallen, and the Burma army were looking for people to do something. I had already been down to the Bilin River and seen Major General Smythe, but that's a different story. This is before the blowing up of the bridge, which cut his division in two. I and the Bush Warfare School were under War Office orders, so the army in Burma couldn't really give us orders, because we were preparing people for operations outside Burma in China. Anyway, I had done a raid with my staff and some Royal Marine commandos in a paddle boat down to Henzadar and attacked the Japanese there, and I'd blown up a lot of trains and ships, which General Slim in his book says was one of the only two offensive operations of the whole campaign. I suddenly got an urgent message to return and to hand over to Musgrave, and I came back to Maymew and the Bush Warfare School. I went into my office, and there was a man sitting at my desk, and he got up and said, "I'm Wingate." I said, "I'm Calvert, and that's my desk." He said, "Oh, I'm sorry." And I'd never heard of Wingate at all. But I met him then, and I went out with him. He took me for some walks, and I found out that he was somebody talking about guerrilla warfare miles ahead of anybody I'd ever met in his knowledge and in his theories and in his knowledge of the jungle. And I talked and walked with him, and I thought, well, now here is somebody who is worth supporting. He wanted to see Chiang Kai-shek, and I got in touch through my contacts and got him on the same aircraft as Chiang Kai-shek and Madam Chiang Kai-shek, and he flew to Chongqing with them and then came back. He had been sent by Wavell, and he had been sent to me, and Wavell had given me a very short note. I consider this a great compliment, to tell Wingate everything I could. Wingate had been sent by Wavell to, if it was found suitable, to take over all the guerrilla activities in Burma. So that they could be coordinated and set up before we evacuated Burma. Wingate then left for China, and he said, "I want you to look after my interests whilst I'm away." It was then that Brocklehurst, Bentinck, and Musgrave, and an officer named Johnson, who was setting up the Kachin levies, presented themselves before Alexander and said that they refused to serve under Wingate. Alexander, who'd only just arrived, nodded his head and heard them. And that's all I know. I went to the G1 operations and said I would also like to see General Alexander and put Wingate's viewpoint. I was sent away with sort of flea in my ear and said I was far too junior to see General Alexander. So I carefully made out a letter stating Wingate's position, that he'd left me in charge to look after his interests, and that I deprecated the action of these four officers. I also sent a copy by somebody who was flying out to India, to Wavell. Anyway, Wingate came back and I showed him what the situation was. And he was very grateful because evidently I was the first person who had treated him seriously. I then took him around Burma, introduced him to people, and we travelled in my staff car, and I took my lady secretary, Mrs. May, M-A-E, Robertson, with us. And we stayed in rest houses, dak bungalows, D-A-K, dak bungalows, en route. And we motored down to Prome, and about 150 miles north of Rangoon, to visit General Slim, who was forming the Burma Brigade after the contretemps and in of the 17th Division and under Smythe, and the loss of Rangoon. I introduced him to Wingate, and Wingate had a long meeting with him where Slim told him, he said, "It's no good, I cannot give you any troops whatsoever, because I need every man I want. And I can get hold of. And there's really no situation for guerrilla warfare." So Wingate came back. At this time, he was dictating all the way around. He was dictating paragraphs to May Robertson, who was taking them down in shorthand. We returned to Maymew, where I was put on the carpet for taking a woman into action without permission. but that went over my shoulders fairly easily. And that's about all of on that particular subject of Count Benting and Brocklehurst and their objections to Alexander. Now, some of the other heads of mission were, each cadre was a mission in itself, with a lieutenant colonel in charge and about four or five officers, plus a cadre of about eight or ten warrant officers and sergeants. So it was fairly highly high-grain lot, and they were a very knowledgeable lot. Before the retreat from Burma, a number of these had been sent into China including one under Gil Davis, which included two Australian cadres, very high-grade lot of officers and NCOs, and others under Munro 4, M-U-N-R-O, F-A-U-R-E, Hector Munro 4, who was an expert on China and there was another Johnson named Colonel Johnson who had been in the Indian political service. He was from the 13th, 14th Frontier Force.
Is that Johnson with an E?
J-O-H-N-S-O-N. Johnson. Johnson. And there was my adjutant, later became my second command, Major Peter Lord, who had been secretary of the Tientsin Club and who was a pillar of strength, knowing all about Chinese, could speak Chinese, and who had a genial knowledge of people's characters, and he was an enormous help to me. I think I explained that I had been enlisted by Colonel Paul Meade, M-E-A-D-E, who had gone down to Australia and had asked for me to become commandant, and I'd shown him around. He went back to India. He'd have loved to have been into action again, but he's fairly old, and he was put in charge of all the senior prisoners of war, Italian prisoners of war, who were held in India. And one of his jobs was to feed them with deception situations before they were sent back to Italy. Now, the head of the mission was General Lancelot, I think his name was, his Christian name was Dennis, D-N-N-I-S, who first Punjabs. I didn't see him much, hardly at all. He was a tremendously energetic, outgoing man, but didn't know much about China. He was killed in an air crash, and his successor was General Bruce. He was the one of the Bruces who had climbed up Mount Everest. Obviously a very brave, courageous man, but I think he found the complications of China very, very difficult. Another character was Major General Gordon Grimsdale, who had been head of military intelligence in Singapore. That is, military intelligence of the whole of the Far East. He was the officer to whom I...